This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Public incidents in the NFL in the past year have put domestic violence front and center, and they've spurred a national conversation about the facts, figures, and stories behind this problem. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, about one in four women and one in seven men in the U.S. have experienced severe physical violence by an intimate partner at some point in their life. In North Carolina alone, there were more than 60 domestic violence homicides in 2014. We're going to spend this hour talking about the problem, and we start with a story of one woman who accidentally became part of the national conversation through Twitter. Beverly Gooden is an HR manager in Charlotte, North Carolina. Last September, she saw the video of NFL player Ray Rice punching his then-fiancée Janae Palmer. Some in the public discourse criticized Janae for staying with Ray. The event prompted Beverly to tweet part of her own story with the hashtag #WhyIStayed. The hashtag took off and has now been used by more than 90,000 others, 90,000 times around the world. Beverly Gooden joins us from sister station WFAE to talk about her story. Bev, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us about your experience with domestic violence and, why you stayed.
I met my ex-husband in college, and we dated for a little while. He was, the perfect boyfriend. He was everything that I wanted. He was kind and active in the church and the community and got along with my friends and my family. And it stayed that way for about the first year of us dating. And then one night, it was my birthday, he had been drinking and he got angry and he threw me up against the wall and started to choke me. And that was the first time that he had ever exhibited any violent behavior towards me. And so instead of running away, my immediate reaction was concern for him. What's wrong? You know, why did you do that? What's going on? Is it something I did? And so I stayed with him after that. And then I actually ended up marrying him about a year later. And the abuse continued. It didn't stop. It was from that moment on until the end of our marriage when I left. And, you know, I stayed for various reasons. I stayed because I loved him. You know, he was my best friend. We had a marriage and I thought that we could work it out. I believed that we could work it out. I stayed because he was the financial provider. He is the one who paid all of our bills. He paid my student loans when I wasn't working. And so I wasn't prepared to uproot my life. And secondly, I wasn't prepared to give up on the person that I loved. And I thought I could work it out. And so that's why I stayed.
You've explained that, and of course you wrote on Twitter a number of reasons why you stayed. Could you read some of those tweets?
Yes. He said he would change. He promised it was the last time. I believed him. He lied. Why I stayed. I stayed because I thought love was enough to conquer all. Why I stayed. I stayed because I was halfway across the country, isolated from my friends and family, and there was no one to help me. Why I stayed.
And you explained that you stayed for a while, but eventually you did leave the marriage. What was the turning point for you?
The turning point was, in my opinion, an escalation of the violence. And so it sounds strange, but when it's, you know, choking and biting and pushing, it seems like you can get past that, that that's not extreme violence. But then it began to get more severe. The pushing turned into trying to push me out of a moving car. And then one day I woke up to him pushing me out of the bed onto the floor, and I just instinctively knew something bad was about to happen. So I started to run, and I ran into the bathroom of our apartment, and he was right there behind me, and he ran in and he punched me, and he started throwing things at me, and he was just basically blocking me from getting out. And in that moment, I knew I could die. It just hit me. I knew this could be my last moment on earth. And I decided that I wanted to live more than I wanted to be married.
How did you get out?
So it took a few months for me to actually leave. Like I said before, I wasn't working at the time. So he had all the money. And so every time he would give me grocery money or gas money or anything like that, I would take a few dollars of it. So siphon a little bit from it, $5 or $10. and save it. So I created a bag, and in the bag it had little shampoos and little soaps and toothpaste and some clothes and a few items that I thought were valuable to me and this money. And so I hid it in the closet, and it took about 2 months, but one day I just grabbed the bag and a few other things that I could hold, and I left, and I went to the domestic violence organization nearby.
What were you feeling in that moment? I mean, you talked about that experience in the bathroom where you realized that your life was in danger. When you actually left, how did you feel?
At first, I was tremendously sad, and I don't think we talk about that part enough. We talk about the success of leaving and how you're free and happy, but I wasn't happy. I was sad. I had left my life. I left the person that I loved. Everything changed in that moment when I left. I didn't have anything. I didn't have a home. I didn't have anywhere to go. And so it was really, really upsetting. And it took a while, but then it became, you know, a happy thing. I was happy that I left. I felt free. But in that moment, I was sad and I was scared because I didn't know what I was going to do.
We talked about you tweeting in the aftermath of the Ray Rice episode. The response surprised you, didn't it? What kind of response did you get?
Yeah, when I first tweeted, I thought to myself, I'm going to tweet these things and hashtag it. And a few of the people that I normally talk to were going to talk about it. So it's going to be maybe 10 or 15 people. So I tweeted it. I was at work at the time, and I was doing payroll. And so I tweeted those first few tweets, and I actually went back to working. I started to do payroll. And about an hour later, I went back to Twitter, and it was trending on Twitter. And that basically means that everyone is talking about it. And it's become a large conversation. And when I first saw it trending, I was like, is that my why I stay? Like, I didn't understand what was happening or why it was trending. But then I realized it is. And the response at first was very surprising and overwhelming, because you don't really see a lot of survivors tell their personal stories in detail. We'll say it, we'll mention it. But men and women were telling detailed stories about why they stayed, detailed stories about their abuse. And just that level of transparency wasn't something that I'd seen online before. So it was incredible.
We're talking about domestic violence today on The State of Things. Bev Gooden is a survivor of domestic violence and an activist who started the hashtag Why I Stayed. You saw all these stories. What about some of the responses? I mean, what was it because I know initially some of the responses were so critical of Janae for staying, and I wonder what was going through your mind and actually prompted you to launch your hashtag.
Yeah, you know, I think that the initial response to the responses saying Janae was stupid or she just wanted his money and no one understood why she stayed, I was angry. I felt anger. I felt guilt, and I felt shame because I knew that I had a similar story, not an identical story, but I knew that I had stayed as well. And so I felt those comments toward Janae, I felt like they were directed at me in a way because of our shared experience. And so I felt anger. I felt that, you know, and I think that there was such a huge response to the hashtag because we had been waiting for this moment. You know, survivors had been waiting for the moment to, one, contribute to the national conversation, but two, to push back against the suggestion that we are partially to blame for the violence. You know, when we asked, you know, why did Janae stay, or accused her, you know, of having motives that aren't good, I think we put the responsibility of the violence on the victim. And that's wrong, you know, because the responsibility for the violence doesn't lie with the victim. It lies with the offender. You know, we're not responsible for the crimes against us. And that's what an assault is. It's a crime. And so in that moment, I just saw, you know, the wrong question being asked. And I wanted to change the conversation.
What effect has the response had on you?
You know, it's made me feel stronger in speaking out. It's caused me to take this on as something that I want to do every day, and I do it every day. But most importantly, it connected me to people who had experienced the same thing I did across the world. And, you know, a lot of times domestic violence is lived in a bubble. you know, when you're living it and you're keeping it secret, it is a secret. And then when you get out, you don't really want to talk about it. At least I didn't. And so the fact that everyone talked about it and we connected with each other online and offline and shared contact information, we've really created a community through social media. And that is the biggest way that it's really changed my life and my experience being a survivor.
I've also seen critiques of all of this, not necessarily that hashtag, but the online conversation about this. The flip side is that it has been too superficial, that in some ways people feel like they've had the conversation, we've talked about this story, and now they've moved on. I mean, is there a danger that we feel like, okay, we got it, now on to the next issue?
I think there is a danger. I think that it is somewhat belittling to say, okay, we talked about it, now let's move on, because we can't move on. You know, this is our life, this is our experience, and there are some people who are still in the relationships for whatever reason. And so there is no let's just move on. This is a conversation that we have to continually have. We have to talk about how to prevent violence. We have to talk about victim blaming and the reasons why people stay. We have to talk about the power and control wheel. We can't stop talking about that. And the issue is so prevalent. You know, 1 in 4 and 1 in 7 is not a small thing. You know, so as long as the issue is here, we have to talk about it. There's no let's move on.
Well, Bev, thank you for getting our conversation started today. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Bev Gooden is a survivor of domestic violence and an activist who started the hashtag Why I Stayed. She spoke with us from WFAE in Charlotte. Our conversation about domestic violence continues on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Today, talking about intimate partner violence. More than 150,000 North Carolinians are victims of domestic violence every year. My guests have spent the majority of their careers working in the domestic violence field. I want to introduce Amelie McCool. She is a systems advocacy coordinator for the North Carolina Coalition Against Domestic Violence. Amelie, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you. I'm honored to be here.
Also joining us is Angelica Wind. She is the director of Our Voice, a Buncombe County Sexual Assault Intervention and Prevention Center. Angelica, welcome to the State of Things.
Well, thank you for having me. Glad to be here.
She spent much of her time and early career working with immigrant women affected by domestic violence. She joins us from our partner station WCQS in Asheville. So let me start with you, Amelie. We just heard from Beverly Gooden some of the common myths about domestic violence. Help us clear up the facts. Who are the victims of domestic violence?
Sure. Well, Frank, really we talk about domestic violence as something, it's a problem that affects everyone in our communities, right? No one is immune to domestic violence, that you can't escape domestic violence because of wealth or because of privilege or because of the color of your skin. It's going to affect everyone in our community. What we do know, obviously, though, is that, you know, there are risk factors. You mentioned the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, that's done these studies and has these rates of domestic violence. And certainly we need to understand how those risk factors contribute to the perpetration and experience of domestic violence in specific communities, so that we make sure that communities, because of racial inequality or socioeconomic inequality, are not disproportionately affected, and that we are addressing those risk factors so that no matter who you are in North Carolina or the United States, that we are working to end the perpetration and experience of domestic violence.
And Angelica, I think this points to one of the thorniest problems around this issue of domestic violence. On the one hand, we need to hold offenders personally responsible for their action. And yet, as Amelie said, there are so many factors outside of that individual, socioeconomic factors that weigh into this. We can't ignore them even as we hold the offender responsible. I mean, is this a pretty complicating factor?
It is a very complicated factor, because we found that sometimes domestic violence is intergenerational as well. But as much as there are risk factors, there are also protective factors as well that the community can look toward working with or increasing to be able to decrease the intergenerational domestic violence that occurs that often we see when a child is raised in a home where there is violence. or exposed to violence.
And when we talk
around
about,
that,
and when we talk about violence, it's more than just physical violence. Can you break that down for us?
Absolutely. So there's this notion when we talk about domestic violence, and it is, again, a very complicated issue. But when we talk about domestic violence, there's this notion that domestic violence is a crime that occurs or an act that occurs as a result of losing control, whether the individual was just angered to the point that they lost control and perpetrated a crime against someone in the same way that the individual perhaps was drinking or perhaps using a substance and then therefore lost control and crossed that boundary. But in actuality, when we talk about domestic violence, it's actually a repeated pattern of behavior that is used to gain and maintain control over their intimate partner. And when we talk about behaviors, they can range anywhere from physical abuse, sexual abuse, to other types of abuse, such as economic abuse, which I think Bev had referred to, intimidation, emotional abuse, isolation, using children as a means to gain and maintain power and control, and at times using male privilege as well.
Emily, North Carolina ranks 19th in the highest number of women dying at the hands of intimate partners. What can we conclude from that ranking?
Well, certainly that North Carolina needs to be taking this issue very seriously and looking at what can we do to reduce the number of domestic violence homicides and domestic violence even that don't result in homicides. What sorts of prevention programs can our communities start putting in place? What are the resources that are being allocated for both prevention and intervention programs at the state level, at the General Assembly, for our criminal justice systems, all of those systems that work together collaboratively that we need to be doing more?
More in what way? You know, we talked about the individual holding them responsible. You and Angelica both have talked about social structures and social design. Talk about that for a minute. What can communities do and what would those programs look like at the larger level, apart from the individual, that could decrease risk factors and increase kind of health factors?
Yeah, well, I think Angelica also mentioned, I mentioned risk factors, she mentioned protective factors, and I think that's really what we know about where we need to be putting our resources, that when we put so much time and resources into one individual, that obviously may help that individual, which is a wonderful thing, but our resources are better utilized if we can actually address those societal factors. So increasing community connectedness, you know, and working to build relationships between people and communities that we know is a protective factor, reducing risk factors, things that we can do in schools, that all of those things reduce all kinds of violence, not just intimate partner violence, you know, bullying, family violence, intimate partner violence, that's where resources need to go.
And Angelica, you've worked especially with immigrant communities. What are some of the unique challenges for them?
Absolutely. So in the work that I've done with immigrant communities and continue to do, one of the challenges first and foremost is language barrier. If we have a recent immigrant who has not has gained the language skills of English, that first and foremost is being able to communicate should the survivor be experiencing or been impacted by domestic violence, is being able to communicate with local service agencies. But aside from that, we're also talking about if the immigrant is perhaps undocumented and is unaware of the fact that they are, despite their legal status, has access to services such as emergency medical care, police assistant, you know, criminal prosecution, and all other community type of services around that piece. But also a misunderstanding of the system here. Oftentimes with a lot of the survivors that I worked with, their legal system in criminal justice system is a little bit different than in their country of origin than in the United States. And so having a lot of the work that I had to do was a lot of outreach and having an education around, one, violence is not acceptable. The fact that the immigrant perhaps has is undocumented, they still have access to services so they can live a life free of violence, and that there are legal remedies that are available for them regardless of status.
Well, there are a number of ways that communities address domestic violence, and some offer services and resources for survivors. Other programs work directly with offenders. North Carolina has more than 50 batterer intervention programs. In Wake County, DOSE, Developing Opportunities for a Safe Environment, provides psychosocial services to abusers and tries to stop violence and hold batterers accountable. The majority of DOSE participants are sent there by the courts, but we spoke with one man who put himself into the program. Mike and his wife Kimberly have been married for almost 5 years. They live in the Triangle. Mike graduated from the DOSE program last year. I spoke with both of them yesterday about their relationship and about what led him to the program, and I asked Mike when he first realized he had a problem.
Looking back, I can now see that there was a problem years and years and years ago. Unfortunately, one evening I crossed the line, and it became physical. And at that moment, that set the wheels in motion. I was out of control. And I had already been seeing a counselor to deal with anger issues. And, you know, he immediately said, look, you've got to get intense help. You need to get enrolled in this program called DOSE.
Kim, when did you first begin to notice some of the things that that Mike is talking about, the early signs?
Pretty much right away. Mike and I, this is our second marriage for both of us, and I came from an abusive marriage, 20 years abusive marriage, and I walked out finally, realizing it wasn't about the children and I needed to not stay for them. And then Mike and I met and we got married, and I noticed it right away within really the first few months of our marriage, but I didn't want to admit to myself that I did this again. You would think I would have learned. And he wasn't as bad. He wasn't physically violent to me. Like, he was physically violent as far as walls and, you know, throwing phones, stuff like that, but never to me. So I, you know, prodded him and tried to kind of wake him up and let him see, you know, this is a problem. This needs to be dealt with. And he just always would excuse it. And it just festered and became worse and worse over a period of 2 to 3 years, actually 3 years. And it escalated the night that Mike's talking about in a very, very bad way. I left the house and went to a hotel. And I didn't press any charges. I actually went to the police station, but I didn't go in spite of a friend's advice. I just didn't.
Can I ask you why you decided not to press charges that night?
Honestly, it was fear. When you're a victim of abuse, I hate to use the word victim because it's my responsibility not to allow myself to be that way, but that's come through a lot of therapy. The abuser takes advantage of your weakness, and you live in kind of a constant state of fear and control on their part. So I was afraid of what might happen if I did that. I don't know why I didn't press charges. Looking back, I wish I had, just for my own self. But, yeah, I don't know.
Mike, what about you? What were you thinking the next day, not sort of in the moment of anger, but as you realized that Kim had left, what were your thoughts?
Well, I think it's important to note, and I will be the first to say this is not why this happened, but I had been drinking that night. One of the first things you learn in DOSE is that it doesn't matter. But that alcohol lessens your reasoning and your rational thinking. Again, I cannot stress enough that it does not excuse the behavior. And DOSE is very clear on that. However, it's not a good mix. It happened. She left. I woke up the next morning, you know, what in the world did I do? What's going to happen now? I can't believe this is happening. And, you know, within short order, probably within a day, I was in my therapist's office, you know, and I think it would be good at this time to mention, as Kimberly said, she didn't press charges. You don't need to be in handcuffs to realize you've got a problem, and you don't need to be in handcuffs to go to DOSE. Now, I'm not saying women should not call if they're abused. By all means, they should get law enforcement involved. My hope would be that there are men or women that can look at their situation and say, it hasn't gotten there yet, but it might, and seek that help out.
I need to add that it's not that it might happen. It will happen. It just sometimes takes a little bit longer. And so those first signs are trust your gut and trust your intuition and get out right away and get help.
And Mike, you talked about, you know, looking in the mirror and saying, look, I need help. And there are these programs out there. DOSE is a court mandated program. There are a lot of people in there who have been ordered into the program. You're not. You chose to enter that program, right?
You're right. You're in there with a bunch of men, 90% of whom don't want to be there. The class runs 6 months, and there's a reason for that. You can break men down within that first month or two and make them realize, look, you're here. Get something out of this. And most men do.
Mike had slapped me in the face 2 years prior to that, and it shook me, and we dealt with it. But even that did not wake him up because he wasn't ready. He just wasn't ready. And he did start seeing a therapist, but he kind of excused Mike's behavior because of his past or the way he was brought up. And with DOSE, they don't do that. She pretty much puts it to him. So.
Well, let me ask you that. What is the difference? Because you were in therapy. You were in therapy, I take it, for anger issues. And then there's DOSE. What's the difference, Mike?
As Kimberly said, I wasn't ready before. This time I was. I was staring down the barrel of a wife, a second wife, who now I had abused, who left me. I was looking at a possible another divorce, my family being ripped apart again, and I just had this wake-up call. And this was very much a three-prong attack. There's no way for me to deny my faith in God and the factor that he has played in this. And DOSE played a critical role in teaching me what real abuse is, and arming me and educating me. My therapist played a key role in getting into deeper, more personal issues. God was the glue that directed it and held it all together. And at the center of that, I had to be willing to accept the consequences and put the time in. And there was a moment in the class, Kimberly alluded to Miss Johnette, the instructor. She's an amazing woman. She's patient, but she's firm. And so Kimberly and I had reconciled, and an argument came up. And it did not get violent, but it got very loud. And it was, that's it. And then Kimberly moved out, this time now for months. So I went to DOSE that week, and I sat down, and I confessed this. And, you know, the men of the group were supportive. They said, look, man, you know, you got to pick yourself up. You know, just continue to work this. You can do it. You know, we've seen you make positive results, which was good to have men supporting you. And then Miss Johnette brought a chair over and sat down next to me. And she let me have it. Not in a mean or angry way, but she basically laid it out and said, what is it going to take? You have the tools. You know them. I know you know them. You've applied them successfully, yet you refuse to completely commit. And after she sat there and really laid it out, I mean, I was broken. You know, I was just tears streaming out, and that was my wake-up call. That was the final nail in the coffin where I said, I have got to change.
You've given a pretty vivid description of how you know, you snap to attention in that moment. And now I'd like to get an idea of what it is that changed in your mind and heart. The difference between what you thought you were doing, you were showing up every day, you were very serious about this, you already realized much earlier the stakes that were involved, a second marriage, etc. So all of that had been pretty clear to you. And then you talked about this commitment. What's the difference between what you were feeling and the sense of commitment that you now felt?
In the past, anytime I tried to make change, it was try to make change for my marriage, try to make change for the woman I was with, try to make change to have peace. That's not change. I had come to the realization I have got to change for myself. My wife might leave me. I may be alone for the rest of my life. There were so many what ifs, but I said, I have got to be in control of myself. I have got to do this for me. And I knew once that happened that my marriage, if it was going to remain, because it was an unknown at that time, my relationship with my children, other relationships would benefit, but it had to be for me.
Part of my conversation with Mike and Kimberly, who live in the Triangle, they spoke about their relationship and domestic violence. We'll hear more of their story in a moment. Also with us, Emily McCool, who is the Systems Advocacy Coordinator for North Carolina's Coalition Against Domestic Violence, and Angelica Wind in Buncombe County, Director of Our Voice, Buncombe County's Sexual Assault Intervention Center and Prevention Center. We'll hear more of that and more of my conversation with Mike and Kimberly when the State of Things continues in a moment. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, today talking about domestic violence. Just before the break, you heard part of my conversation with Mike and Kimberly, a couple who has been married for 5 years. Mike was abusive, and at one point, things got so bad that he says he was one step away from handcuffs. He chose to participate in a batterer intervention program and graduated last year. I asked Kim what changes she's noticed in Mike.
Oh, wow. There's a lot. But I would say at the core, he is a completely different man. I look at him and he looks the same, but his heart, his eyes, looking in his eyes, I mean, he changed. And I think that he did that because of what he just shared with you. He decided to do it for himself, not for me or his children or anything, just for himself, which is really important.
How do you think you've changed in all of this?
I've actually changed a lot, too. I'm a stronger woman. I don't allow myself to be treated that way anymore. I speak up.
Well, what about you? Let me ask you, Mike, changes that you've noticed in Kim.
She really hit the big ones on the head. Her tolerance for my old stupidity went out the window, which is a good thing. She is a stronger person. I can see it. And I'm proud of her for those changes because she is better for it. I am not perfect. There are times I'll get frustrated. It is nowhere near what I used to do. But the simple time now, I could get worked up over something, not even between us, like maybe something happened at work or I don't know, but just kind of get worked up where my voice raises and it's not raising out of anger or anything. And I'll just look at her and I can see it like, oh my gosh, this is triggering an emotion in her that is reminding her of what I was. And I will reel it in. And if I don't catch it, she is the first to point it out. She's like, this is unacceptable. You got to chill out right now. Go calm down. You know, and she knows I'm not mad at her. There's not a fight brewing here. It's just that I'm getting worked up. And we just don't have that anymore. We don't tolerate it.
Well, you know, you've said a remarkable thing. I think it's incredible and profound. When you said, Mike, you had to do it for yourself. In other words, you really let go of everything, including all the things that you thought were important to you. Someone might have heard you say, when I did it for myself, it may have sounded like a kind of selfishness.
Yeah.
But clearly you two are in a relationship, and it's a stronger relationship. So it's about the two of you. I mean, it's an interesting thing that precisely what you did was to let go of all those other things, which is about you in that sense, is really ultimately about relationship. You can't get to the relationship until you let go personally of everything that you think is important. I mean, it's a paradox in a way, and I just
exactly.
wanted to...
Exactly.
It absolutely is. You, I guess maybe an easier way to look at it, and I understand when I said that, I knew it could come across as selfish, but I was hoping, you know, you'd clarify that. you have to let go of everything because everything's broken. Everything you were trying to hold together, sadly, I can be very controlling. That definitely contributed to the factors involved, too, with my anger. You've got to let it all go. And my motto kind of in the DOSE program became no expectations. And what I meant by that is I'm changing for me. I'm changing because it's the right thing to do. It's the healthy thing to do. I have no expectations with my marriage. I would always show Kimberly how much she means to me, how much I love her. But there were plenty of times it was not reciprocated because of the damage I had done. So I had to say no expectations in that and continue to love her, continue to love myself, continue to change, hoping it would reunite us. But I could not hang anything on those expectations. It would have derailed everything.
Well, I know this must have been difficult for you at some moment to come on and talk publicly about this situation, and you have, and you've shared a great deal of your personal lives with us. What is it that you would hope others listening to this program are going to take away?
Well, I told Kimberly last night when we decided to do this, and you're right, it wasn't easy for either of us, especially Kimberly. I said, if one person hears this broadcast, and seeks help and gets help and changes, then it was worth sharing our story.
Kim?
I think for me, I would hope anyone listening to this can see that it can be done on both parts. It takes, you know, just a lot of commitment to yourself. But it's worth it. It's a completely different life. It's the way life should be.
Well, I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Frank. Glad we could help.
It was part of my conversation with Mike and Kimberly, a couple who live in the Triangle. They spoke about domestic violence and their relationship and how they are dealing with it. With me again, Emily McCool is the Systems Advocacy Coordinator for the North Carolina Coalition Against Domestic Violence, and Angelica Wind, Director of Our Voice, Buncombe County Sexual Assault Intervention and Prevention Center. Emily, you just heard Mike and Kimberly's story. How much of that was typical, particularly of someone who had been in a batterer intervention program?
Well, Frank, I think actually a lot of it is started out atypically because he shared that he went voluntarily to that program. And as he said, that is very unusual. That, I mean, really probably 98 to 99% of the folks who go through batterers intervention program are there through the courts, either through criminal court or through child protective services. And they're doing it because in their mind, they have to avoid jail or to avoid losing their children. And that same level of investment that you heard from Mike isn't there in the same way that a lot of those batterers go through that program. So I think it was very atypical in that specific instance and how he came to the program and his willingness to really integrate the information. And you heard that even coming voluntarily, he really struggled to make real change. And it took months and it took further incidents and it took him leaving, even there as a volunteer. And so I think that that conveys sort of the difficulty that faces folks who are being abusive towards their partners and going through these programs, those challenges.
Do we have any data on the success rate of batterer intervention programs?
We do. And I think it's important to sort of be clear about what we mean when we say success. So when we're, you know, there's research on, are these programs successful in actually changing beliefs and behavior on the part of people who have been abusive towards their partner? Unfortunately, that research is not promising, that at least statistically speaking, there's not a very significant change in actual behavior or attitudes over time for the majority of people that go through that program. That's due to a lot of reasons. As we said, it's not voluntary for most folks. There's a very high dropout rate. Almost 50% usually in programs report that 50% of participants drop out before they complete the program. And I thought it was really telling what Mike said about, you know, having to do it for himself. I think the importance of acknowledging that people benefit from power and how difficult it must be to relinquish all of the privilege that comes from having that power, and that all of these external forces may never be enough for someone to relinquish power until they make that individual choice, as Mike said he did for himself, that, you know what, actually, I want to live this other way, because our society values power over equality.
And that's it. The reinforcement all around us, every commercial we watch, every impulse, every indication we get from the highest circles of power reinforce whatever the public service announcement might say on TV. Everything else on that television is reinforcing something else. So, Angelica, in Buncombe County, I know Buncombe County has been working on developing a new plan to address domestic violence. Can you tell us about it?
Absolutely. So the plan formulated, and I think you had given the stats earlier about 2004, but in 2003, Buncombe County was the third highest of any county in the state in terms of domestic violence-related deaths. There were five that were a result of intimate partner violence. And so at that point, thanks to the Buncombe County commissioners, especially County Commissioner Holly Jones, started the conversation of what is it that we can do to change what is currently happening in Buncombe County. And as a result, in May of 2014, Buncombe County unveiled and unrolled their comprehensive plan on domestic violence. And it's a six-point plan at this point that takes on basically what the county has done, is looked across the nation to see what is being done around intervention in response to domestic violence. And what we have been able to do is identify 6 points that are evidence-based and brought them back to this county and implemented. And I'm proud to say that we're the only county in the nation that is currently using this comprehensive plan.
Well, tell us about it. Go ahead.
So it's 6 points. The first one is through the Enough campaign, which is based on the work by the NC Council for Women and Domestic Violence Commission, which is a campaign that increases public awareness. I think that when we talk about the lack of conversations around domestic violence, how frequently it occurs and what the dynamics are and how it's not so black and white and there's a lot of gray. Public awareness is the first step around starting those conversations and also informing the community that violence isn't tolerated and that there are resources available to individuals that are being impacted by domestic violence. Another piece of it is a cross-system dialogue, which is based on the work by the National Council of Family and Juvenile Court Justice. And the focus around that is improving communication around agencies. We have found that oftentimes when survivors of domestic violence reach out, they may only be reaching out to one agency or are reaching out to multiple agencies, but there's no communication or as effective communication as we'd like between the agencies of trying to provide the services to ensure that the survivor is safe and making sure that they are able to access the resources that they are needing. Another is the electronic monitoring system, which is a system that's based on the work that's being done in Pitt County, North Carolina. And it's a way of tracking offenders in order to ensure victim safety. And so that what that is the electronic monitoring system on the perpetrator during pretrial release. The other piece, which is crucial around, especially about domestic violence homicides, is lethality assessment, training community agencies and the community on being able to do lethality assessments. Because one of the things that we have research has noted is when there are DV homicides, there are generally a lot of warning signs prior to the homicide, whether it be strangulation, threats to commit suicide or threats with a firearm. All these are indicators that the likelihood of a DV homicide is likely to occur. So part of this is based on the work by Dr. Jacqueline Campbell of Johns Hopkins University and the Maryland Domestic Violence Network, is to ensure that the community is trained to be able to spot situations when they come across around someone who's been impacted by violence, to be able to do a lethality assessment and refer that person to the appropriate resources, and also to be able to point out that there is a genuine threat of a possible homicide should the violence continue to escalate.
We have another piece. Oh, go ahead.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. The other piece is a high-risk team, which is based on the work in greater Newport, Massachusetts, around a high-risk team. And that is basically the creation of what is known as a community-coordinated response, where agencies come together around the highest danger cases and be able to create safety planning with the individual, and as well as better accountability around the offender, such as law enforcement response. And the last piece is focused deterrence, which is a prevention strategy for previous offenders. It's based on the work that's currently done in High Point, North Carolina. And the way that that works is when there's a domestic violence call, law enforcement has to respond to, a letter will subsequently be mailed to the offender saying, we've got this call and we are watching you. You know, in terms of we've got our eyes on you in terms of what your behavior will be in the future or what could possibly happen. So basically saying we've got our eyes on you.
We have links to all of these programs that we've been talking about at our website, stateofthings.org. We have very little time left. Emily, let me ask you, I know you've done some of the tracking on this. Domestic violence has an impact on more than just the couple involved. It is the whole community. And in fact, it's an economic issue. Can you talk to us briefly about that?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it really emphasizes how this is not just an individual private issue, that because of domestic violence, we see losses from productivity where victims can't go to work either because they have visible injuries that they don't want to go to work and be seen, or they actually are recovering from injuries, and perpetrators who are maybe incarcerated. And so there's that economic impact. There's the health impact from going to hospitals and getting those services. There's all the cost involved with what we need for criminal justice responses. So, you know, there's an enormous economic impact. And, you know, there was a study done by the folks out at UNC Charlotte about this economic impact and trying to estimate that. And I think, you know, it was around $307 million, you know, dollars of cost to North Carolina in 1 year from the impact of domestic violence.
I want to thank all of you for being on the program. I certainly wish we had more time, but Emily McCool is the Systems Advocacy Coordinator for the North Carolina Coalition Against Domestic Violence. Emily, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Also with us is Angelica Wind, Executive Director of Our Voice in Asheville. She joined us from WCQS in Asheville. Thanks, Angelica.
Thank you so much for having me.
And thank you for listening to our program. As I said, we've got links to resources at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Hadi Mawagdi, and Will Michaels. Robin Copley is the technical director. Jess Clark is our intern. Brent Wolf, WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.